You're listening to highlights of One Planet Podcast's interview with writer and musician Aaron Caffell, author of the novel All the Water in the World.
I was raised by a father who was obsessed with utopian communities. He made Shaker furniture and studied, had a huge library of all of these utopianist projects within American culture. And I was also raised in a family that was very interested in talking about not only the ways in which we as human beings keep records over the course of our existence on the planet from a European perspective. My aunt is a medievalist, and so she really wanted me to understand the ways in which these religious communities that survive great change within human culture are the places that record the memory of the previous civilizations and kind of hold on to them for the next generation. But also, I'm very aware that I'm writing as an American, and as American, you have to recognize that you're living on land that has experienced a very recent, within the last 300 years, massive apocalypse of the people and the way of life that existed here before colonialism came to this part of the world. And when you tell the story of America, I think it's an instinct, I think, for a lot of writers, especially those of us in speculative fiction, to recognize that we are revisiting a story that has existed before, that when we tell a story about collapse, we have to take into account the ways in which the Christian history of the settlers and the colonial project maps over the incredible human history of the retention of information, the response to shift in culture, and the possibility of change. What we hold on to when the worst thing happens to the established culture that kind of works and functions and makes sense to the people that are involved in it. I couldn't write the book just from a perspective of the museum is one thing or the logbook is one thing, because we have the privilege of being able to see and understand this larger human project of trying to hold on to what matters the most. That we are in a complex and delicately balanced relationship of connection to everything else on the planet. I think of it as one of the gifts of neurodivergent thinking is this idea of spiderweb thinking, where we begin to recognize and write into and speak into the complex interdependence and interconnection of every gesture that we make on the planet. So when I'm thinking about the ways in which we have this cultural story of the pristine Earth, right, or the Earth we've never messed up, the thing that humans were, at some point, we were really good stewards and we didn't make any changes. I think that tells a lie that still places us in kind of a very Christian-centered perspective of there's us and then there's everything else. And I think most storytelling that I really respond to, whether it's from my own culture or from previous civilizations, is storytelling that acknowledges that we are in this complex relationship where every gesture we make is connected to the lives of every other creature on the planet. Non-human animals, more than human life forms, plants, the ecosystem itself. It's trying to present as much as possible narratives and language and thought processes for us to absorb as people that state emphatically and with a lot of joy that every action we have has another action, and so too the actions of the more than human kin that we live with. It's that interconnectedness that we lose when we have a story of humans that can either do wrong or right, and then everything else, right? It's that integration that we need to be able to take in. It's not new. It's not original to the work I'm doing, the work of other writers doing this kind of work right now. But I think it's fallen out of the way that we think about ourselves in relation to the planet and in relation to the culture we've built. And I think the more narratives that we allow to be complex in that way and to be interconnected, the more that we begin to change our brain chemistry around how do we protect ourselves and also everything that is in relation to us. And this narrative that we have that there's an ecosystem and it's either broken or whole, and we either have ruined it and we don't have to worry about it because it's ruined and we can just keep ruining it, or it's fixed and we can't really touch it anymore. Those binary relationships to the way that we regard the planet are part of the problem. When we start seeing ourselves in a constant relationship to the gains and losses of conservation, because you can have a great win and things can get a lot better and then they can be reversed by politics or changes to the environment, the more that you have that evolving relationship with it that's dynamic, that's alive to the moment you're in, and that's not afraid of the feelings of fear or hopelessness or grief or pain that attend paying close attention to the world as it is evolving around you, the better we are able to be flexible in the relationship we need to form with fixing what we can and holding on to what we have. The more we rely on that black and white thinking of either we're in grief or we're out of it, we've got a loss and we have to move on, or we don't and we're fine. The more that happens, the more difficult it is to flow into, I think, what we really are going to need in terms of emotional flexibility to get through the staggering changes that are starting to happen as regards climate issues. Absolutely, it's an act of resistance. And I think, you know, it's sort of an inborn response to a disease diagnosis in youth when I found out that I carried the same disease as my family. And it shifts one's thinking into a real sense of like legacy, generations, what am I inheriting from my family? What am I passing on? And also sort of what is my relationship to how to find, maintain, and really deeply appreciate the beauty of a life that you are being told is going to be cut short or is going to be complicated. And I think we're kind of all in that moment right now where we've been given this complex diagnosis, if we choose to listen to it, about what could happen with the worst case scenario in terms of the climate, in terms of global warming, in terms of eco collapse and extinction. And I think there are two ways to go in response. And one is to be very emotionally shut down, to stop seeing beauty, to think only of use, or to be so deep in fear that you're thinking mostly about what you get to retain financially in terms of your legacy in a very black and white kind of capitalist thinking of like, what can I leave behind for my children? But I think there's a second way to go, which is that you can open up to the gift of mortality and to the gift of fragility and vulnerability that is either in the personal diagnosis or the global one that says, oh, but then this proximity to loss provides you with the clarity of being able to see the vulnerability and the aliveness and the fragility of everything that you are surrounded by. And I think if you take that direction, if you trust that you can work through your feelings and that you don't have to sit in fear, then what is revealed to you is just the incredible glory of every moment that you get to be on the planet observing, feeling, experiencing. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of fear and sort of alarm bell thinking in the way that we respond to what's happening globally right now that is appropriate. But if we stay there, then we are just as close and proximal to fear as someone who's in denial or in rejection of the reality. When we acknowledge the fear and acknowledge the grief and begin to allow ourselves to flexibly move through it, to have a relationship, a right relationship to it, then we begin to be able to see the things that we have that are still here, that are so worth preserving, that are still beautiful and thriving, that can still be saved and prolonged. And I think, you know, for me as a writer who dwells in this space, you know, all day, every day, what I need to do often is I go to the woods every week, or I go to the ocean a couple of times a year. I just came back from crossing the country and going to deserts and mountains and hot springs and seeing the complexity of the natural environment. And if I have a lens across that experience that says it's all doomed, it's ruined, we can't save anything, the worst is coming, then I don't actually fully participate in the glory of what is here. I can see what's lost already. You know, I'm trained to see it. But to be able to stay in the moment to see what is still available, what if my life is still available, even as a person with a disease, is really, it's a discipline that I think has these incredible rewards, which is that you get to hold both the fear and grief and pain on one side and be really gentle with it and then still be really alive to what's still available and glorious in human experience. What's interesting, as a musician, I feel like I'm still working on a new record at some point, starting to think about recording it. It's written. But what's true about me as an artist is that I'm constantly thinking of the same sets of questions on every project that I'm working on. And so a lot of my music is the same set of projects, which is thinking about water, thinking about family, thinking about what it means to love and lose, and how we hold on to what's glittering in the darkness. I think that the project of being an artist is an activist practice. And I think a lot about, is it Tony Cade Bambara who said, the role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible? I'm paraphrasing, but I think that's pretty close. And when I sit down to write, when I try to tell complex stories, even fictional stories, what I'm trying to do is to put a story on the page that enables people to gather strength to do the complicated work that they alone can do, right? The activists that are out there in this moment, whether they do it for a lifetime or for a season, they need narrative and story and art and music that makes them feel filled back up again with the passion for their work so that they can go back out and do it the next day. And like my organizer husband, he's deep in the labor movement and has been for 30 years. And what he does to recharge at the end of the day is read poetry and sometimes read theory and cultural criticism, but he goes back to poetry. He goes back to music. And so do all of the people that I know and love who do this kind of work. I became aware very early that I was not cut out to be a scientist because I'm much more interested in the big picture and how every piece of scientific inquiry connects to every other piece rather than finding my corner and working it. And I've felt a lot of grief about that over the years because I love scientists so much. And I think that that is just some of the most important work that happens anywhere. And so there are days certainly when my work doesn't feel as vital as activism or science or medicine, but I keep coming back to the fact that you need something to strive for, that yearning that your quote talks about. It's not just the yearning for the open sea or for the big project of being a human on the planet at this moment, but the individual life within those yearnings where we need something to be working for. And the beauty and the poetry and the complexity of storytelling is what we're fighting to keep, right? It's not inessential. It is the reminder every day of what it is we are trying to protect as much as the forest that I go walk in or the right whale that I like to see from the boat. And so we have these stories throughout human history of people making this decision to protect. And so I spent a lot of time imagining what their rules for life would be and what they would be doing in order to make sure that even if the worst came to pass and the museum itself was destroyed, there was the knowledge of what was in the museum that could be passed on in this logbook that could be wrapped up in oilcloth and taken on a canoe as they do and moved north to a place where when things can be put back together again, that information, that knowledge, and that understanding still exists. And that as they're living there, they have a complex relationship to what's being protected, where they only use things from the collections that they absolutely have to use and that they're trying to protect and record as much as possible. And then, you know, the relationship of those people to what it looks like to imagine a future when things can be put back together is very important. They're all trying to hold on and to gift to the next generation. Even if I don't get to see it, even if I personally, your mother, or father, I'm not the person who rebuilds. I'm training you for a life that imagines rebuilding, that imagines repair, that imagines, you know, human society coalescing again after the end of the world. And for me, that was incredibly important because I don't want to just tell a dystopian story where everything is terrible all the time. I want to be able to talk about what I'm afraid of happening globally, but I want to make sure that it's grounded in the reality that humans do, we do rebuild. Even when the worst things happen. And we do create beloved communities in the face of incredibly stark circumstances. Every project I've ever worked on has been a collaborative project. I may be the author that's on the title of the record or the novel, but I am surrounded by people that you can't see in these interviews that are readers and editors and people that I bounce ideas off of and scientists that I'm listening to and thinkers that have come before me. And I think that same idea that I'm trying to get into my books about the relay race of knowledge and understanding is very true about the artist's life as well. This is something where we can't operate effectively and beautifully within a sense of if I don't do it myself, it isn't really me. It isn't really art. I have to be this sort of lone genius working it out on my own. I think that the more that we see ourselves as part of an ecosystem of vulnerability and complexity, that we make better work and we can have it have relevance for more people and for more time. Dreamed I saw it run me down
outside the door of the bar. We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening. The starving,
stars.